recognize the urgency of the situation? Some do, but many oppose helping us in this war, and they seek to delay the proceedings as long as possible, and to install one of their own upon the marble throne in Trondheim. The dwarves have lived in hiding for so long they have become dangerously suspicious of outsiders. If someone hostile to our aims wins the throne, we shall lose the dwarves. We cannot allow that to happen, nor can we wait for the dwarves to resolve their differences at their usual pace. But, she raised a finger, from so far away I cannot effectively intervene in their politics. Even if I were in Trondheim, I could not ensure a favourable outcome. The dwarves do not take kindly to anyone who is not of their clans meddling in their government. So I want you, Eragon, to travel to Trondheim in my stead, and do what you can to ensure that the dwarves choose a new monarch in an expeditious manner, and that they choose a monarch who is sympathetic to our cause.
Me?
But King Hrothgar adopted you into Durgrimstingetum. According to their laws and customs, you are a dwarf, Eragon. You have a legal right to participate in the hall meets of the Ingetum, and as Oric is set to become their chief, and as he is your foster brother and a friend of the Vardens, I am sure he will agree to let you accompany him into the secret councils of the 13 clans, where they elect their rulers. Her proposal seemed preposterous to Eragon.
What about Murtagh and Thorn? When they return, as they surely will, Saphira and I are the only ones who can hold our own against them, albeit with some assistance. If we are not here, no one will be able to stop them from killing you or Arya or Orin or the rest of the Varden.
The gap between Nasawada's eyebrows narrowed. You dealt Murtagh a stinging defeat yesterday. Most likely he and Thorn are winging their way back to Urabain even as we speak, so Galbatorix may interrogate them about the battle and chastise them for their failure. He will not send them to attack us again until he is confident that they can overwhelm you. Murtagh is surely uncertain about the true limits of your strength now, so that unhappy event may yet be some while off. Between now and then, I believe you will have enough time to travel back and forth between Farthendur.
You could be wrong, argued Eragon. Besides, how would you keep Galbatorix from learning about our absence and attacking while we are gone? I doubt you have found all of the spies he has seeded among us.
Nasawada tapped her fingers on the arms of her chair.
I said I wanted you to go to Farthendur, Eragon. I did not say I wanted Saphira to go as well.
Turning her head, Saphira released a small puff of smoke that drifted toward the peak of the tent.
I'm not about to—
Let me finish, please, Eragon.
He clamped shut his jaw and glared at her, his left hand tight around the pommel of the falchion.
You are not beholden to me, Saphira, but my hope is that you will agree to stay here while Eragon journeys to the dwarves, so that we can deceive the Empire and the Varden as to Eragon's whereabouts. If we can hide your departure, she gestured at Eragon, from the masses, no one will have any reason to suspect you are not still here. We will only have to devise a suitable excuse, then, to account for your sudden desire to remain in your tent during the day. Perhaps that you and Saphira are flying sorties into enemy territory at night, and so must rest while the sun is up. In order for the ruse to work, however, Blodgam and his companions will have to stay here as well, both to avoid arousing suspicion and for reasons of defence. If Murtagh and Thorn reappear while you are gone, Arya can take your place on Saphira. Between her, Blodgam's spellcasters, and the magicians of Duvrangar Gata, we should have a fair chance of thwarting Murtagh.
In a harsh voice, Eragon said,
If Saphira doesn't fly me to Farthendur, then how am I supposed to travel there in a timely fashion?
By running. You told me yourself you ran much of the distance from Helgrind. I expect that without having to hide from soldiers or peasants, you can traverse many more leagues each day on the way to Farthendur than you were able to in the Empire.
Again, Nasawada drummed the polished wood of her chair.
Of course, it would be foolish to go alone. Even a powerful magician can die of a simple accident in the far reaches of the wilderness if he has no one to help him. Shepherding you through the Beor Mountains would be a waste of Arya's talents, and people would notice if one of Blodgarm's elves disappeared without explanation. Therefore, I have decided that a cull should accompany you, as they are the only other creatures capable of matching your pace.
A cull? Exclaimed Aragorn, unable to contain himself any longer. You would send me among the dwarves with a cull by my side? I cannot think of any race the dwarves hate more than the Urgals. They make bows out of their horns. If I walked into Farthendur with an Urgal, the dwarves would not pay heed to anything I had to say.
I am well aware of that, said Nasawada, which is why you will not go directly to Farthendur. Instead, you will first stop at Bregenhold on Mount Thardor, which is the ancestral home of the Injitum. There you will find Oric, and there you can leave the cull while you continue on to Farthendur in Oric's company.
Staring somewhat beyond Nasawada, Aragorn said, And what if I do not agree with the path you have chosen? What if I believe there are other, safer ways to accomplish what you desire?
What ways would those be, pray tell? Asked Nasawada, her fingers pausing in midair.
I would have to think about it, but I'm sure they exist.
I have thought about it, Aragorn, and at great length. Having you act as my emissary is our only hope of influencing the succession of the dwarves. I was raised among dwarves, remember, and I have a better understanding of them than most humans.
I still believe it's a mistake, he growled.
Send Jormungandr instead, or one of your other commanders. I won't go, not while...
You won't?
Said Nasawada, her voice rising.
A vassal who disobeys his lord is no better than a warrior who ignores his captain on the field of battle, and may be punished similarly. As your liege lord, then, Aragorn, I order you to run to Farthendur, whether you want to or not, and to oversee the choosing of the next ruler of the dwarves.
Furious, Aragorn breathed heavily through his nose, gripping and re-gripping the pommel of his falchion. In a softer, although still guarded, tone, Nasawada said, What will it be, Aragorn? Will you do as I ask, or will you dispossess me and lead the Varden yourself? Those are your only options. Shocked, he said,
No! I can reason with you. I can convince you otherwise.
You cannot, because you cannot provide me with an alternative that is as likely to succeed. He met her gaze.
I could refuse your order and let you punish me however you deem fit.
His suggestion startled her. Then she said, To see you lashed to a whipping post would do irreparable harm to the Varden, and it would destroy my authority, for people would know you could defy me whenever you wanted, with the only consequence being a handful of stripes that you could heal an instant later. For we cannot execute you, as we would any other warrior who disobeyed a superior. I would rather abdicate my post and grant you command of the Varden than allow such a thing to occur. If you believe you are better suited for the task, then take my position, take my chair, and declare yourself master of this army. But so long as I speak for the Varden, I have the right to make these decisions. If they be mistakes, then that is my responsibility as well.
Will you listen to no advice? Aragorn asked, troubled. Will you dictate the course of the Varden, regardless of what those around you counsel?
Nasawada's middle fingernail clacked against the polished wood of her chair. I do listen to advice. I listen to a continuous stream of advice every waking hour of my life, but sometimes my conclusions do not match those of my underlings. Now you must decide whether you will uphold your oath of fealty and abide by my decision, even though you may not agree with it, or if you will set yourself up as a mirror image of Galbatorix.
I only want what is best for the Varden, he said.
As do I. You leave me no choice but one I dislike.
Sometimes it is harder to follow than it is to lead.
May I have a moment to think?
You may.
Sapphira, he asked.
Flecks of purple light danced around the interior of the pavilion as she twisted her neck and fixed her eyes upon Aragorn's.
Little one!
Should I go?
I think you must.
He pressed his lips together in a rigid line.
And what of you?
You know I hate to be separated from you, but Nasawada's arguments are well reasoned. If I can help keep Murtagh and Thorn away by remaining with the Varden, then perhaps I should.
His emotions and hers washed between their minds. Tidal surges in a shared pool of anger, anticipation, reluctance, and tenderness. From him flowed the anger and reluctance. From her, other, gentler sentiments, as rich in scope as his own, that moderated his choleric passion and lent him perspectives he would not otherwise have. Nevertheless, he clung with stubborn insistence to his opposition to Nasawada's scheme.
If you flew me to Farthendur, I would not be gone for as long, meaning Galbatorix would have less of an opportunity to mount a new assault.
But his spies would tell him the Varden were vulnerable the moment we left.
I do not want to part with you again so soon after Helgrind.
Our own desires cannot take precedence over the needs of the Varden. But no, I do not want to part with you either. Still, remember what Oromis said, that the prowess of a dragon and rider is measured not only by how well they work together, but also by how well they can function when apart. We are both mature enough to operate independently of each other, Aragorn. However much we may dislike the prospect, you proved that yourself during your trip from Helgrind.
Would it bother you, fighting with Arya on your back, as Nasawada mentioned?
Her I would mind least of all. We have fought together before, and it was she who ferried me across Alagazia for nigh on 20 years when I was in my egg. You know that, little one. Why pose this question? Are you jealous?
What if I am?
An amused twinkle lit her sapphire eyes. She flicked her tongue at him.
Then it is very sweet of you. Would you I should stay or go?
It is your choice to make, not mine.
But it affects us both.
Aragorn dug at the ground with the tip of his boot. Then he said,
if we must participate in this mad scheme, we should do everything we can to help it succeed. Stay, and see if you can keep Nasawada from losing her head over this thrice-blasted plan of hers.
Be of good cheer, little one. Run fast, and we shall be reunited in short order.
Aragorn looked up at Nasawada.
Very well, he said. I will go.
Nasawada's posture relaxed somewhat.
Thank you. And you, Sephira? Will you stay or go?
Projecting her thoughts to include Nasawada as well as Aragorn, Sephira said,
I will stay, Nightstalker.
Nasawada inclined her head.
Thank you, Sephira. I am most grateful for your support.
Have you spoken to Blodgarm of this? Asked Aragorn. Has he agreed to it?
No. I assumed you would inform him of the details.
Aragorn doubted the elves would be pleased by the prospect of him travelling to Farthendur with only an Urgell for company. He said,
If I might make a suggestion. You know I welcome your suggestions.
That stopped him for a moment.
A suggestion and a request, then.
Nasawada lifted a finger, motioning for him to continue.
When the dwarves have chosen their new king or queen, Sephira should join me in Farthendur, both to honour the dwarves' new ruler, and to fulfil the promise she made to King Hrothgar after the battle for Trondheim.
Nasuada's expression sharpened into that of a hunting wildcat. "What promise was this?" she asked. "You have not told me of this before?" "That Saphira would mend the star sapphire Isidar Mithrim, as recompense for Arya breaking it." Her eyes wide with astonishment, Nasuada looked at Saphira and said, "You are capable of such a feat?"
"I am, but I do not know if I will be able to summon the magic I will need when I am standing before Isidar Mithrim. My ability to cast spells is not subject to my own desires. At times, it is as if I have gained a new sense, and I can feel the pulse of energy within my own flesh. And by directing it with my will, I can reshape the world as I wish. The rest of my life, however, I can no more cast a spell than a fish can fly. If I could mend Isidar Mithrim, though, it would go a long way toward earning us the goodwill of all the dwarves, not just a select few who have the breadth of knowledge to appreciate the importance of their cooperation with us."
"It would do more than you imagine," said Nasuada. "The star sapphire holds a special place in the hearts of dwarfs. Every dwarf has a love of gemstones. But Isidar Mithrim they love and cherish above all others, because of its beauty, and most of all, because of its immense size. Restore it to its previous glory, and you will restore the pride of their race." Aragorn said, "Even if Saphira failed to repair Isidar Mithrim, she should be present for the coronation of the dwarves' new ruler. You could conceal her absence for a few days by letting it be known among the Varden that she and I have left on a brief trip to Arboron or some such. By the time Galbatorix's spies realize you had deceived them, it would be too late for the Empire to organize an attack before we returned." Nasuada nodded. "It is a good idea. Contact me as soon as the dwarves set a date for the coronation."
"I shall."
"You have made your suggestion. Now, out with your request. What is it you wish of me?"
"Since you insist I must make this trip, with your permission, I would like to fly with Saphira from Trondheim to Ellesmere after the coronation."
"For what purpose?"
"To consult with the ones who taught us during our last visit to Dueldumvarden. We promised them that as soon as events allowed, we would return to Ellesmere to complete our training."
The line between Nasawada's eyebrows deepened. "There is not the time for you to spend weeks or months in Ellesmere continuing your education."
"No, but perhaps we have the time for a brief visit."
Nasuada leaned her head against the back of her carved chair and gazed down at Aragorn from underneath heavy lids.
"And who exactly are your teachers? I have noticed you always evade direct questions about them. Who was it that taught the two of you in Ellesmere, Aragorn?"
Fingering his ring, Arryn, Aragorn said, "We swore an oath to Islan Zadi that we would not reveal their identity without permission from her, Arya, or whoever may succeed Islan Zadi to her throne."
"By all the demons above and below, how many oaths have you and Saphira sworn?" demanded Nasuada. "You seem to bind yourself to everyone you meet."
Feeling somewhat sheepish, Aragorn shrugged and had opened his mouth to speak, when Saphira said to Nasuada,
"We do not seek them out. But how can we avoid pledging ourselves when we cannot topple Galbatorix and the Empire without the support of every race in Alagazia? Oaths are the price we pay for winning the aid of those in power."
"Hmph," said Nasuada. "So I must ask Arya for the truth of the matter."
"Aye. But I doubt she will tell you. The elves consider the identity of our teachers to be one of their most precious secrets. They will not risk sharing it unless absolutely necessary to keep word of it from reaching Galbatorix."
Aragorn stared at the royal blue gemstone set in his ring, wondering how much more information his oath and his honor would allow him to divulge, then said,
"Know this, though. We are not so alone as we once assumed."
Nasuada's expression sharpened. I see. That is good to know, Aragorn. I only wish the elves were more forthcoming with me.
After pursing her lips for a brief moment, Nasuada continued,
Why must you travel all the way to Ellesmere? Have you no means to communicate with your tutors directly?
Aragorn spread his hands in a gesture of helplessness.
If only we could. Alas, the spell has yet to be invented that can broach the wards that encircle Duweldenwarden. The elves did not even leave an opening they themselves can exploit. If they had, Arya would have contacted Queen Islanzadi as soon as she was revived in Farthendur, rather than physically going to Duweldenwarden.
I suppose you are right. But then how was it you were able to consult Islanzadi about Sloane's fate?
You implied that when you spoke with her, the elves' army was still situated within Duweldenwarden.
They were, he said, but only in the fringe, beyond the protective measures of the wards.
The silence between them was palpable, as Nasuada considered his request. Outside the tent, Aragorn heard the Nighthawks arguing among themselves about whether a bill or a halberd was better suited for fighting large numbers of men on foot. And beyond them, the creak of a passing ox-cart, the jangle of armour on men trotting in the opposite direction, and hundreds of other indistinct sounds that drifted through the camp. When Nasuada spoke, she said,
What exactly do you hope to gain from such a visit?
I don't know, growled Aragorn.
He struck the pommel of the falchion with his fist.
And that's the heart of the problem. We don't know enough. It might accomplish nothing. But on the other hand, we might learn something that could help us vanquish Murtagh and Galbatorix once and for all. We barely won yesterday, Nasuada. Barely. And I fear that when we again face Thorne and Murtagh, Murtagh will be even stronger than before, and frost coats my bones when I consider the fact that Galbatorix's abilities far exceed Murtagh's, despite the vast amount of power he has already bestowed upon my brother. The elf who taught me, he...
Aragorn hesitated, considering the wisdom of what he was about to say, then forged onward.
He hinted that he knows how it is Galbatorix's strength has been increasing every year, but he refused to reveal more at the time because we were not advanced enough in our training. Now, after our encounters with Thorne and Murtagh, I think he will share his knowledge with us. Moreover, there are entire branches of magic we have yet to explore, and any one of them might provide the means to defeat Galbatorix. If we are going to gamble upon this trip, Nasuada, then let us not gamble to maintain our current position. Let us gamble to increase our standing, and so win this game of chance.
Nasuada sat motionless for over a minute.
I cannot make this decision until after the dwarves hold their coronation. Whether you go to Duweldenwarden will depend on the movements of the Empire then, and on what our spies report about Murtagh and Thorne's activities.
Over the course of the next 2 hours, Nasuada instructed Aragorn about the 13 dwarf clans. She schooled him in their history and their politics, in the products upon which each clan based the majority of its trade, in the names, families, and personalities of the clan chiefs, in the list of important tunnels excavated and controlled by each clan, and in what she felt would be the best way to coax the dwarves to elect a king or queen friendly to the goals of the Varden.
Ideally, Oric would be the one to take the throne, she said. King Hrothgar was highly regarded by most of his subjects, and Durgrim Stingetum remains one of the richest and most influential of clans, all of which is to Oric's benefit. Oric is devoted to our cause. He has served as one of the Varden. You and I both count him as a friend, and he is your foster brother. I believe he has the skills to become an excellent king for the dwarves.
Amusement kindled in her expression. Small matter, that.
However, he is young by the standards of the dwarves, and his association with us may prove to be an insurmountable barrier for the other clan chiefs. Another obstacle is that the other great clans, Durgrimst Feldunost and Durgrimst Nolkarathen, to name but two, are eager, after over 100 years of rule by the Injitum, to see the crown go to a different clan. By all means, support Oric if it can help him onto the throne. But if it becomes obvious that his attempt is doomed, and your backing could guarantee the success of another clan chief who favours the Varden, then transfer your support, even if doing so will offend Oric. You cannot allow friendship to interfere with politics, not now.
When Nasuada finished her lecture on the dwarf clans, she, Aragorn and Saphira spent several minutes figuring out how Aragorn could slip out of the camp without being noticed. After they had finally hammered out the details of the plan, Aragorn and Saphira returned to their tent and told Blodgarm what they had decided. To Aragorn's surprise, the fur-covered elf did not object. Curious, Aragorn asked, "Do you approve?"
"It is not my place to say whether I approve or not," Blodgarm replied, his voice a low purr. "But since Nasuada's stratagem does not seem to put either of you in unreasonable danger, and by means of this you may have the opportunity to further your learning in Ellesmere, neither I nor my brethren shall object." He inclined his head. "If you will excuse me, Bjartskule, Arjedlam."
Skirting Saphira, the elf exited the tent, allowing a bright flash of light to pierce the darkness inside as he pushed aside the entrance flap. For a handful of minutes, Aragorn and Saphira sat in silence. Then Aragorn put his hand on the top of her head.
"Say what you will. I will miss you."
"And I you, little one."
"Be careful. If anything happened to you, I would..."
"And you as well."
He sighed. "We have been together only a few days, and already we must part again. I find it hard to forgive Nasuada for that."
"Do not condemn her for doing what she must."
"No, but it leaves a bitter taste in my mouth."
"Move swiftly, then, so I may soon join you in Fardendur."
"I wouldn't mind being so far away from you, if only I could still touch your mind. That's the worst part of it, the horrible sense of emptiness. We dare not even speak to each other through the mirror in Nasuada's tent, for people would wonder why you kept visiting her without me."
Saphira blinked and flicked out her tongue, and he sensed a strange shift in her emotions.
"What?" he asked.
"I..."
She blinked again.
"I agree. I wish we could remain in mental contact when we were at great distances from each other. It would reduce our worry and trouble, and would allow us to confound the Empire more easily."
She hummed with satisfaction as he sat next to her, and began to scratch the small scales behind the corner of her jaw. Footprints of Shadow. With a series of giddy leaps, Saphira carried Aragorn through the camp to Roran and Katrina's tent. Outside the tent, Katrina was washing a shift in a bucket of soapy water, scrubbing the white fabric against a board of ridged wood. She lifted a hand to shield her eyes as a cloud of dust from Saphira's landing drifted over her. Roran stepped out of the tent, buckling on his belt. He coughed and squinted in the dust.
"What brings you here?"
he asked, as Aragorn dismounted. Speaking quickly, Aragorn told them of his impending departure, and impressed upon them the importance of keeping his absence a secret from the rest of the villagers.
"No matter how slighted they feel, because I supposedly refuse to see them, you cannot reveal the truth to them, not even to Horst or Elaine. Let them think I have become a rude and ungrateful lout before you so much as utter a word about Nasuada's scheme. This I ask of you for the sake of everyone who has pitted themselves against the Empire. Will you do it?"
"We would never betray you, Aragorn," said Katrina. "Of that you need have no doubts."
Then Roran said that he too was leaving.
"Where?" exclaimed Aragorn.
"I just received my assignment a few minutes ago. We are going to raid the Empire's supply train somewhere well north of us, behind enemy lines."
Aragorn gazed at the three of them in turn. First Roran, serious and determined, already tense with anticipation of battle. Then Katrina, worried and trying to conceal it. And then Saphira, whose nostrils flickered with small tongues of flame which sputtered as she breathed.
"So, we are all going our separate ways."
What he did not say, but which hung over them like a shroud, was that they might never again see each other alive. Grasping Aragorn by the forearm, Roran pulled him close and hugged him for a moment. He released Aragorn and stared deep into his eyes.
"Guard your back, brother. Galbatorix isn't the only one who would like to slip a knife between your ribs when you aren't looking. Do the same yourself, and if you find yourself facing a spellcaster, run in the opposite direction. The wards I placed around you won't last forever."
Katrina hugged Aragorn and whispered,
"Don't take too long."
"I won't." Together, Roran and Katrina went to Saphira and touched their foreheads to her long, bony snout. Her chest vibrated as she produced a pure bass note deep within her throat.
"Remember, Roran," she said.
"Do not make the mistake of leaving your enemies alive. And Katrina, do not dwell on that which you cannot change. It will only worsen your distress."
With a rustle of skin and scales, Saphira unfolded her wings and enveloped Roran, Katrina, and Aragorn in a warm embrace, isolating them from the world. As Saphira lifted her wings, Roran and Katrina stepped away, while Aragorn climbed onto her back. He waved at the newlywed couple, a lump in his throat, and continued waving even as Saphira took to the air. Blinking to clear his eyes, Aragorn leaned against a spike behind him and gazed up at the tilting sky.
"To the cook tents now?"
asked Saphira.
"Aye."
Saphira climbed a few hundred feet before she aimed herself at the southwestern quadrant of the camp, where pillars of smoke drifted up from rows of ovens and large, wide pit fires. A thin stream of wind slipped past her and Aragorn as she glided downward toward a clear patch of ground between two open-walled tents, each 50 feet long. Breakfast was over, so the tents were empty of men when Saphira landed with a loud thump. Aragorn hurried toward the fires beyond the plank tables, Saphira beside him. The many hundreds of men who were busy tending the fires, carving meat, cracking eggs, kneading dough, stirring cast-iron kettles full of mysterious liquids, scrubbing clean enormous piles of dirty pots and pans, and who were otherwise engaged in the enormous and never-ending task of preparing food for the Varden, did not pause to gawk at Aragorn and Saphira. For what importance was a dragon and rider compared with the merciless demands of the ravenous, many-mouthed creature whose hunger they were striving to sate? A stout man with a close-cropped beard of white and black, who was almost short enough to pass for a dwarf, trotted over to Aragorn and Saphira and gave a curt bow.
"I'm Quoth Merinson. How can I help you? If you want, Shadeslayer, we have some bread that just finished baking."
He gestured toward a double row of sourdough loaves resting on a platter on a nearby table.
"I might have half a loaf if you can spare it," said Aragorn. "However, my hunger isn't the reason for our visit. Saphira would like something to eat, and we haven't time for her to hunt as she usually does."
Quoth looked past him and eyed Saphira's bulk, and his face grew pale.
"How much does she normally... how much do you normally eat, Saphira? I can have 6 sides of roast beef brought over immediately, and another 6 will be ready in about 15 minutes. Will that be enough, or..."
The knob in his throat jumped as he swallowed. Saphira emitted a soft, rippling growl which caused Quoth to squeak and hop backward.
"She would prefer a live animal, if that's convenient," Aragorn said.
In a high-pitched voice, Quoth said,
"Convenient? Oh yes, it's convenient."
He bobbed his head, twisting at his apron with his grease-stained hands.
"Most convenient indeed, Shadeslayer, Dragon Saphira. King Orin's table will not be lacking this afternoon, then. Oh, no."
and a barrel of mead,"
Saphira said to Aragorn. White circles appeared around Quoth's irises as Aragorn repeated her request.
I am afraid that the dwarves have purchased most of our stocks of mead. We have only a few barrels left, and those are reserved for King..."
Quoth flinched as a four-foot-long flame leaped out of Saphira's nostrils and singed the grass in front of him. Snarled lines of smoke drifted up from the blackened stalks.
I will have a barrel brought to you at once. If you will follow me, I will take you to the livestock, where you may have whatever beast you like."
Skirting the fires and tables and groups of harried men, the cook led them to a collection of large wooden pens, which contained pigs, cattle, geese, goats, sheep, rabbits, and a number of wild deer the Varden's foragers had captured during their forays into the surrounding wilderness. Close to the pens were coops full of chickens, ducks, doves, quail, grouse, and other birds. Their squawking, chirping, cooing, and crowing formed a cacophony so harsh it made Aragorn grit his teeth with annoyance. In order to avoid being overwhelmed by the thoughts and feelings of so many creatures, he was careful to keep his mind closed to all but Saphira. The three of them stopped over 100 feet from the pens, so Saphira's presence would not panic the imprisoned animals.
"Is there any here catches your fancy?"
Quoth asked, gazing up at her and rubbing his hands with nervous dexterity. As she surveyed the pens, Saphira sniffed and said to Aragorn,
"What pitiful prey! I'm not really that hungry, you know. I went hunting only the day before yesterday, and I'm still digesting the bones of the deer I ate."
"You're still growing quickly. The food will do you good."
"Not if I can't stomach it."
"Pick something small, then. A pig, maybe."
"That would hardly be of any help to you. No, I'll take that one."
From Saphira, Aragorn received the image of a cow of medium stature, with a splattering of white splotches on her left flank. After Aragorn pointed out the cow, Quoth shouted at a line of men idling by the pens. Two of them separated the cow from the rest of the herd, slipped a rope over its head, and pulled the reluctant animal toward Saphira. 30 feet from Saphira, the cow balked and lowed with terror, and tried to shake free of the rope and flee. Before the animal could escape, Saphira pounced, leaping across the distance separating them. The two men who were pulling on the rope threw themselves flat as Saphira rushed toward them, her jaws gaping. Saphira struck the cow broadside as it turned to run, knocking the animal over and holding it in place with her splayed feet. It uttered a single, terrified bleat before Saphira's jaws closed over its neck. With a ferocious shake of her head, she snapped its spine. She paused then, crouched low over her kill, and looked expectantly at Aragorn. Closing his eyes, Aragorn reached out with his mind toward the cow. The animal's consciousness had already faded into darkness, but its body was still alive, its flesh thrumming with motive energy, which was all the more intense for the fear that had coursed through it moments before. Repugnance for what he was about to do filled Aragorn, but he ignored it, and placing a hand over the belt of Beloth the Wise, transferred what energy he could from the body of the cow into the 12 diamonds hidden around his waist. The process took only a few seconds. He nodded to Saphira.
"I'm done."
Aragorn thanked the men for their assistance, and then the two of them left him and Saphira alone. While Saphira gorged herself, Aragorn sat against the barrel of mead and watched the cooks go about their business. Every time they or one of their assistants beheaded a chicken or cut the throat of a pig or a goat or any other animal, he transferred the energy from the dying animal into the belt of Beloth the Wise. It was grim work, for most of the animals were still aware when he touched their consciousness, and the howling storm of their fear and confusion and pain battered at him until his heart pounded and sweat
beaded his brow, and he wished nothing more than to heal the suffering creatures. However, he knew it was their doom to die, lest the Varden should starve. He had depleted his reserve of energy during the past few battles, and Aragorn wanted to replenish it before setting out on a long and potentially hazardous journey. If Nasuada had allowed him to remain with the Varden for another week, he could have stocked the diamonds with energy from his own body, and still had time to recuperate before running to Farthendur. But he could not in the few hours he had. And even if he had done nothing but lie in bed and pour the fire from his limbs into the gems, he would not have been able to garner as much force as he did then from the multitude of animals. The diamonds in the belt of Belot the Wise seemed to be able to absorb an almost unlimited amount of energy, so he stopped when he was unable to bear the prospect of immersing himself in the death throes of another animal. Shaking and dripping with sweat from head to toe, he leaned forward, his hands on his knees, and gazed at the ground between his feet, struggling not to be ill. Memories not his own intruded upon his thoughts. Memories of Saphira soaring over Leona Lake with him on her back, of them plunging into the clear, cool water, a cloud of white bubbles swarming past them, of their shared delight in flying and swimming and playing together. His breathing calmed, and he looked at Saphira where she sat among the remnants of her kill, chewing on the cow's skull. He smiled and sent her his gratitude for her help.
"We can go now," he said.
Swallowing, she replied,
"Take my strength as well. You may need it."
"No."
"This is one argument you will not win. I insist."
"And I insist otherwise. I won't leave you here weakened and unfit for battle. What if Murtagh and Thorn attack later today? We both need to be ready to fight at any moment. You'll be in more danger than I will, because Galbatorix and the whole of the Empire will still believe I'm with you."
"Yes, but you will be alone with a cull in the middle of the wilderness."
"I am as accustomed to the wilderness as you. Being away from civilization does not frighten me. As for a cull, well, I don't know if I could beat one at a wrestling match, but my wards will protect me from any treachery." "I have enough energy, Saphira. You don't need to give me more." She eyed him, considering his words, then lifted a paw and started licking it clean of blood.
"Very well. I will keep myself to myself."
The corners of her mouth seemed to lift with amusement. Lowering her paw, she said,
"Would you be so kind as to roll that barrel over to me?"
With a grunt, he got to his feet and did as she asked. She extended a single talon and punched two holes in the top of the barrel, which released the sweet smell of apple honey mead. Arching her neck so her head was directly above the barrel, she grasped it between her massive jaws, then lifted it skyward and poured the gurgling contents down her gullet. The empty barrel shattered against the ground when she dropped it, and one of the iron hoops rolled several yards away. Her upper lip wrinkled. Saphira shook her head, then her breath hitched, and she sneezed so hard that her nose struck the ground and a gout of fire erupted from both her mouth and her nostrils. Aragorn yelped with surprise and jumped sideways, batting at the smoking hem of his tunic. The right side of his face felt seared raw by the heat of the fire.
"Saphira, be more careful!" he exclaimed.
"Oops!"
She lowered her head and rubbed her dust-caked snout against the edge of one foreleg, scratching at her nostrils.
"The mead tickles."
"Really, you ought to know better by now," he grumbled as he climbed onto her back. After rubbing her snout against her foreleg once more, Saphira leaped high into the air and, gliding over the Varden's camp, returned Aragorn to his tent. He slid off her, then stood looking up at Saphira. For a time, they said nothing, allowing their shared emotions to speak for them.
Saphira blinked, and he thought her eyes glistened more than normal.
"This is a test," she said. "If we pass it, we shall be the stronger for it, as dragon and rider."
"We must be able to function by ourselves if necessary, else we will forever be at a disadvantage compared with others."
"Yes."
She gouged the earth with her clenching claws.
"Knowing that does nothing to ease my pain, however."
A shiver ran the length of her sinuous body. She shuffled her wings.
"May the wind rise under your wings, and the sun always be at your back. Travel well, and travel fast, little one."
"Goodbye," he said. Aragorn felt that if he remained with her any longer, he would never leave. So he whirled around and, without a backward glance, plunged into the dark interior of his tent. The connection between them, which had become as integral to him as the structure of his own flesh, he severed completely. They would soon be too far apart to sense each other's minds anyway, and he had no desire to prolong the agony of their parting. He stood where he was for a moment, gripping the hilt of the falchion and swaying as if he were dizzy. Already the dull ache of loneliness suffused him, and he felt small and isolated without the comforting presence of Saphira's consciousness. "I did this before, and I can do this again," he thought, and forced himself to square his shoulders and lift his chin. From underneath his cot, he removed the pack he had made during his trip from Hellgrind. Into it, he placed the carved wooden tube wrapped in cloth that contained the scroll of the poem he had written for the Egeti Blodron, which Oromis had copied for him in his finest calligraphy, the flask of enchanted Faelnerve, and the small soapstone box of Nalgask that were also gifts from Oromis, the thick book Domir Aberwyrda, which was Jode's present, his whetstone and his strop, and after some hesitation, the many pieces of his armour. For he reasoned, "If the occasion arises where I need it, I will be more happy to have it than I will be miserable carrying it all the way to Farthan Dûr." Or so he hoped. The book and the scroll he took because, after having done so much travelling, he had concluded that the best way to avoid losing the objects he cared about was to keep them with him wherever he went. The only extra clothes he decided to bring were a pair of gloves which he stuffed inside his helmet, and his heavy woolen cloak, in case it got cold when they stopped nights. All the rest he left rolled up in Saphira's saddlebags. "If I really am a member of Durgrimstingetum," he thought, "they will clothe me properly when I arrive at Bregenhold." Cinching off the pack, he lay his unstrung bow and quiver across the top, and lashed them to the frame. He was about to do the same with the falchion, when he realized that if he leaned to the side, the sword could slide out of the sheath. Therefore he tied the sword flat against the rear of the pack, angling it so the hilt would ride between his neck and his right shoulder, where he could still draw it if need be. Aragorn donned the pack, and then stabbed through the barrier in his mind, feeling the energy surging in his body and in the 12 diamonds mounted on the belt of Beloth the Wise. Tapping into that flow of force, he murmured the spell he had cast but once before, that which bent rays of light around him and rendered him invisible. A slight pall of fatigue weakened his limbs as he released the spell. He glanced downward and had the disconcerting experience of looking through where he knew his torso and legs to be and seeing the imprint of his boots on the dirt below. "Now for the difficult part," he thought. Going to the rear of the tent, he slit the taut fabric with his hunting knife and slipped through the opening. Sleek as a well-fed cat, Blodgarm was waiting for him outside. He inclined his head in the general direction of Aragorn and murmured, "Shade Slayer." Then devoted his attention to mending the hole, which he did with a half-dozen short words in the ancient language. Aragorn drifted down the path between two rows of tents, using his knowledge of woodcraft to make as little noise as possible. Whenever anyone approached, Aragorn darted off the path and stood motionless, hoping they would not notice the footprints of shadow in the dirt or on the grass.
He cursed the fact that the land was so dry. His boots tended to raise small puffs of dust, no matter how gently he lowered them. To his surprise, being invisible degraded his sense of balance. Without the ability to see where his hands or his feet were, he kept misjudging distances and bumping into things, almost as if he had consumed too much ale. Despite his uncertain progress, he reached the edge of the camp in fairly good time, and without arousing any suspicion. He paused behind a rain barrel, hiding his footprints in its thick shadow, and studied the packed earth ramparts and ditches lined with sharpened stakes that protected the Varden's eastern flank. If he had been trying to enter the camp, it would have been extremely difficult to escape detection by one of the many sentinels who patrolled the ramparts, even while invisible. But since the trenches and the ramparts had been designed to repel attackers and not imprison the defenders, crossing them from the opposite direction was a far easier task. Aragorn waited until the two closest sentinels had their backs turned toward him, and then he sprinted forward, pumping his arms with all his might. Within seconds he traversed the 100 or so feet that separated the rain barrel from the slope of the rampart, and dashed up the embankment so fast he felt as if he were a stone skipping across water. At the crest of the embankment he drove his legs into the ground, and arms flailing, leaped out over the lines of the Varden's defences. For three silent heartbeats he flew, then landed with a bone-jarring impact. As soon as he regained his balance, Aragorn pressed himself flat against the ground and held his breath. One of the sentinels paused in his rounds, but he did not seem to notice anything out of the ordinary, and after a moment he resumed his pacing. Aragorn released his breath and whispered, "Dutaloi Lunea," and felt as the spell smoothed out the impressions his boots had left in the embankment. Still invisible, he stood and trotted away from the camp, careful to step only on clumps of grass so he would not kick up more dust. The farther he got from the sentinels, the faster he ran, until he sped over the land more quickly than a galloping horse. Almost an hour later, he danced down the steep side of a narrow draw that the wind and rain had etched into the surface of the grasslands. At the bottom was a trickle of water lined with rushes and cattails. He continued downstream, staying well away from the soft ground next to the water, in an attempt to avoid leaving traces of his passage, until the creek widened into a small pond, and there by the edge he saw the bulk of a bare-chested cull sitting on a boulder. As Aragorn pushed his way through a stand of cattails, the sound of rustling leaves and stalks alerted the cull of his presence. The creature turned his massive horned head toward Aragorn, sniffing at the air. It was Nar Garshvag, leader of the Urgals who had allied themselves with the Varden. "You!" exclaimed Aragorn, becoming visible once more.
"Greetings, Fire Sword," Garshvag rumbled. Heaving up his thick limbs and giant torso, the Urgal rose to his full 8.5 feet, his grey-skinned muscles rippling in the light of the noonday sun.
"Greetings, Nar Garshvag," said Aragorn. Confused, he asked, "What of your rams? Who will lead them if you go with me?"
"My blood brother, Skagragresh, will lead. He is not Kull, but he has long horns and a thick neck. He is a fine war chief."
"I see. Why did you want to come, though?" The Urgal lifted his square chin, baring his throat.
"You are Fire Sword. You must not die, or the Urgralgra, the Urgals as you name us, will not have our revenge against Galbatorix, and our race will die in this land. Therefore I will run with you. I am the best of our fighters. I have defeated 42 rams in single combat."
Aragorn nodded, not displeased by the turn of events. Of all the Urgals, he trusted Garshvag the most, for he had probed the Kull's consciousness before the Battle of the Burning Plains, and had discovered that by the standards of his race,
Gajvarg was honest and reliable.
As long as he doesn't decide that his honor requires him to challenge me to a duel, we should have no cause for conflict.
Very well, Nargajvarg, he said, tightening the strap of the pack around his waist. Let us run together, you and I, as has not happened in the whole of recorded history.
Gajvarg chuckled deep in his chest.
Let us run, Fire Sword.
Together they faced east, and together they set forth for the Beor Mountains, Aragorn running light and swift, and Gajvarg loping beside him, taking one stride for every two of Aragorn's, the earth shuddering beneath the burden of his weight. Above them, swollen thunderheads gathered along the horizon, portending a torrential storm, and circling hawks uttered lonesome cries as they hunted their prey. Over Hill and Mountain. Aragorn and Nargajvarg ran for the rest of the day, through the night and through the following day, stopping only to drink and to relieve themselves. At the end of the second day, Gajvarg said,
Fire Sword, I must eat and I must sleep.
Aragorn leaned against a nearby stump, panting, and nodded. He had not wanted to speak first, but he was just as hungry and exhausted as the cull. Soon after leaving the Varden, he had discovered that while he was faster than Gajvarg at distances of up to 5 miles, beyond that, Gajvarg's endurance was equal to or greater than his own. I will help you hunt, he said.
That is not needed. Make us a big fire, and I will bring us food.
Fine. As Gajvarg strode off toward a thicket of beech trees north of them, Aragorn untied the strap around his waist, and with a sigh of relief, dropped his pack next to the stump.
Blasted armor, he muttered.
Even in the Empire, he had not run so far while carrying such a load. He had not anticipated how arduous it would be. His feet hurt, his legs hurt, his back hurt. And when he tried to crouch, his knees refused to bend properly. Trying to ignore his discomfort, he set about gathering grass and dead branches for a fire, which he piled on a patch of dry, rocky ground. He and Gajvarg were somewhere just east of the southern tip of Lake Tudostan. The land was wet and lush, with fields of grass that stood 6 feet high, through which there roamed herds of deer, gazelles, and wild oxen with black hides and wide, back-swept horns. The riches of the area were due, Aragorn knew, to the Beor Mountains, which caused the formation of huge banks of clouds that drifted for many leagues over the plains beyond, bringing rain to places that would otherwise have been as dry as the Haderach Desert. Although the two of them had already run an enormous number of leagues, Aragorn was disappointed by their progress. Between the Jeet River and Lake Tudostan, they had lost several hours while hiding and taking detours to avoid being seen. Now that Lake Tudostan was behind them, he hoped that their pace would increase.
Nasuada didn't foresee this delay, now did she? Oh no. She thought I could run flat out from there to Farthan Dûr.
Ha! Kicking at a branch that was in his way, he continued to gather wood, grumbling to himself the entire time. When Gajvarg returned an hour later, Aragorn had built a fire a yard long and 2 feet wide, and was sitting in front of it, staring at the flames, and fighting the urge to slip into the waking dreams that were his rest. His neck cracked as he looked up. Gajvarg strode toward him, holding the carcass of a plump doe under his left arm. As if it weighed no more than a sack of rags, he lifted the doe and wedged its head in the fork of a tree 20 yards from the fire. Then he drew a knife and began to clean the carcass. Aragorn stood, feeling as if his joints had turned to stone, and stumbled toward Gajvarg.
"How did you kill it?" he asked.
"With my sling," rumbled Gajvarg.
Do you intend to cook it on a spit? Or do Urgals eat their meat raw?
Garjvard turned his head and gazed through the coil of his left horn at Aragorn, a deep-set yellow eye gleaming with some enigmatic emotion.